We're heading for the biggest crash since the Great Depression, and it's around the corner, according to US demographer Harry Dent, who's telling anyone who's prepared to listen that we're heading for a stock market crash and the value of your house and my house will drop by up to 40%. Well, today I'm going to chat with Harry Dent in what's actually going to be a pretty long interview, and then I'm going to speak with Pete Warchant, and together Pete and I will give you our views on what's ahead, and as you can imagine, they're very different to what Harry Dent has to say. Now, if you're not familiar with Harry Dent, he comes to Australia every couple of years, usually when he's got a new book to promote, and he throws the cat amongst the pigeons by predicting Armageddon, and in the process gets lots of publicity for his books and seminars. He's been on 60 Minutes and on most television shows and in the media a lot. Of course, with COVID, he can't come to Australia, but he's still happy to share his views on the future, and as you'll hear today, he's very passionate. Now, I interviewed Harry in May last year, in 2020, and also in 2018, and both times he suggested property values could fall 40%. But that hasn't happened, has it? So I guess the question to ask is he right this time? Is the market going to collapse? Is the world going to fall into a deep recession? So I invited Harry Dent back on my podcast because I know he's not the only one who believes we're heading for a major recession. His good friend Robert Kiyosaki thinks the same. I wanted to hear firsthand what he wanted to say rather than just poo-pah his thoughts without giving him a fair chance to get his point of view across. I also wanted you to have the opportunity to hear Harry, hear what he had to say in a longer interview rather than the short grabs that the media normally gives him. So we go on for quite some time, and you're going to hear in this long interview that he's very passionate. You're going to hear his thoughts about when the downturn will occur, what's going to happen between now and then. You'll hear his views on Bitcoin, on gold and silver, as well as some good news ahead, well, in his mind anyway, once the downturn is over. Now, rather than debating Harry, and you'll be able to hear that I couldn't get a word in edgewise most of the time, I thought it rather fair to just give him the opportunity to get his point across. And then afterwards, you'll hear my chat with Pete Warchant, where we're going to give you our views on what we see ahead for our economy and the property markets. Now, before we get into the interview, I want to give you a word of warning, especially for the faint-hearted. There are some scary predictions made by Harry. So please listen to the whole interview and then don't sell up your assets before you hear my views and those of Pete Warchant. So you're in for some fun, some entertainment, a different point of view. Welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardley Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
It's great to have US demographer and author Harry Dent back with me again on today's podcast. Harry is a Harvard MBA graduate, a Fortune 100 consultant, and his demographic-based approach to economic forecasting has helped him correctly predict many, many major economic events, including way back, I remember, Japan's 1989 economic collapse, the 2000 dot-com bust, and the populist wave enabling Brexit and Donald Trump's elections. Now, he's also got a daily newsletter, so if you want to subscribe, you can do that for free to get his insights. Welcome, Harry.
Nice to be back, Michael.
Now, Harry, I know my regular listeners will think I've got a different view to you on what's ahead, but I'm still looking forward to our chat because I'm sure you're going to suggest an alternative viewpoint. And as an investor myself, I believe it's important to listen to others. I'd rather do that than walk around with blinkers on and only believe my own preconceived ideas of the world. Now, Harry, I've been following you for a long time, and nowadays many people would be calling you a perma-bear. You've been negative for a long time, but that's not always been the case, was it? I remember when I read your first book, you were very bullish.
I was the most bullish guy in all of history. Even the people in the roaring 20s were not as bullish as me because I had my demographic information early on back in the 80s said this baby boom generation, especially in the developed world and especially in Australia, is going to be the largest ever to hit and we're going to have the greatest boom in history. Nobody's going to see it coming. I'm only got bearish after 2007 when that generation had peaked in spending, which I predicted back in the 80s that by late 2007, they'd be done and we'd have a slowdown. Well, guess what? The only reason we're growing now outside of Australia that still has positive demographics is because governments are printing unlimited amounts of money and stimulus to keep a dead economy alive. And this is not good policy and will not end well.
Well, Harry, we spoke about a year ago and you told us there was an economic bubble going to burst. Australia's property values were going to crash. What's the biggest surprise you had over the last year?
Well, you know, it was that I was saying, you know, when COVID first hit, I said, you know, this is a perfect trigger, you know, because it's a short-term shock. But man, my biggest surprise was governments stepped up exponentially. I mean, 10 times. They used it as an excuse to just go all out. So I would not have expected as big a response, because not only did in the US and most other developed countries in Europe and create much more monetary stimulus very quickly, but they added a lot of fiscal stimulus, which they held off on. So in the last year and a half, we've seen just an unprecedented amount of stimulus. And the US has led this one. You know, Europe and Japan had always printed more money and stimulated more than the U.S., and that's because their demographics are weaker. So my surprise was, my gosh, the government stepped up this large and got away with it. And so I think that we're starting, I know in the U.S., and I think this has got to be starting to creep in Australia, housing prices have now gotten so high, literally just in the last year, up 20-30%. That it is crimping demand. Demand is down 23% in the U.S. since January. Now, that's the Achilles heel, because people keep saying, well, Harry, they'll keep printing money. I said, I know, but this has diminishing returns. And they've been printing since 2008 nonstop and escalating since COVID off the charts exponentially. So there is a limit to how much something for nothing you can get and how much you can stimulate people to buy when they've already refinanced their house a third or fourth time or already bought a trade-up home bigger, you know, and all this. I mean, there's only so much you can do. Oh, and then their kids leave the nest and you've paid for college and people get older. And of course, this is more true in the U.S. and Europe and more true in Europe than the U.S. And older people really don't have much place to spend money. I mean, they don't have their kids to put into college and do all this stuff for. So this is just an inevitable thing. But that's the biggest sign I've seen in the U.S. is in the last 5 or 6 months, home sales have gone straight down despite the economy holding up and all this stimulus and getting mortgage loans for 3%, for crying out loud, when they should be 6 and historically have been 6-9%, you know. So this is the cracks. You don't get something for nothing. And if you keep stimulating and stimulating, you will hit limits on how you get people to spend money when they're not really making it in real terms and it's not a real economy anymore and it's all stimulus. I mean, without these low interest rates, housing wouldn't be so affordable and housing wouldn't be so high priced. Housing would have gotten overpriced 10 years ago in Australia and the United States if it hadn't been for these low, artificially low mortgage rates, which means, oh gosh, on the same mortgage payment, you can buy 30, 40, 50% more house. But people have done that.
Well, there's no doubt that's one of the reasons house values in Australia have gone up. Interest rates are low. So even with the same income, you can afford more. But why do you say they're artificially low, Harry?
What governments are doing around the world, the developed countries, they are taking money printed out of nowhere, okay? And they're not giving it, until the COVID crisis, they weren't giving it to businesses or consumers direct as stimulus. They take money and they buy bonds in the open market, and then the companies that sell those bonds turn around and reinvest that in higher return assets, which it always ends up in stocks, you know, in REITs and real estate, stuff like that. So they've been basically, since late 2008, they put in trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars into the financial asset pool that just bids them up. So stocks in real estate and bonds, everything. Bonds bonds are the treasury bonds, the government bonds of the United States are acting like there's 0 to 1% inflation with their rates instead of 2 to 3 to 4. Why? They're overvalued. There's more money chasing financial assets. Those financial assets go up. And what that does, Michael, it doesn't affect the everyday family that much. A little bit of their home goes up, but they don't own a lot of stocks and financial assets and bonds and stuff. It basically makes the rich get richer. And 20% of the households in Australia and in the US and most developed countries spend 50% of the money. So that it's the 20% that benefits the most, and really the top 10 and the top one progressively, but those people spend an outsized amount of money. So they do have a big, my characterization, people say, well, Harry, we're growing at, 1.5-2%. I said, well, that's the worst in history. But I say, you know what that 2% is? It's 4-5% for the top 20%, and it's zero for the other 80. So again, it's helping the more fluent more. It's all artificial. If you don't pay a real interest rate that prices in inflation over time, which again, a 10-year treasury bond, I think is about, 1.5 right now percent. It should be, inflation's running 3-4, but really sustainably 2-3, it should be 4%. So these bonds are worth more. They're acting like interest rates are lower, and that makes mortgage loans lower and means people can buy more house than they can afford. And one of these days, those rates will go back up and they won't be able to afford those houses, or certainly they will have traded up more enough for all their life and their next lifetime, if that exists. So it's artificial. Governments are adding money. The first they've done it since 2008, largely buying financial assets, which trickles into a little bit more spending for everyday people and a good bit more for affluent people. Now, in the crisis, especially in Europe and the United States, they are doing fiscal stimulus. And trillions of dollars in the U.S. now committed to just giving money to businesses calling up, 800, give me money. Oh, I want 100 grand. Okay, done. Just invest it in something. Act like you're investing. This is just a something for nothing scheme. What's happened here, and it wasn't by intention, the 2008 crisis was the worst in a long time, okay? I was predicting that forever, okay? Because the baby boom would drive us up higher than anybody thought, and then suddenly stop spending after 2007. And they suddenly stopped spending after 2007. Exactly what the demographics say, because it's a predictable, precise science, like a life insurance actuary telling you when you're going to die on average, okay? And I'm not predicting individuals, I'm predicting large populations of people, like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, United States, Great Britain, that sort of stuff. So this stuff is accurate. So it did slow. So governments didn't understand that in the first place. They're thinking, oh, we just have a short-term financial crisis. So if we put a bunch of money in, then we'll be okay in a year or two. This is just a short-term crisis. No. My indicators said it from the beginning. 2008 to 2023 will be the biggest downturn since 1930 to 1942. Okay? And it'll be deflationary in prices. Because I have indicators all, again, based on people and demographics, not on complicated economic models. What do people do as they age? How do they cause inflation or not? How do they cause spending or not? Young people are inflationary because they don't produce anything and they cost everything. And then they become productive. They become the best citizens. Old people basically are deflationary. They just spend less and liquidate more and get older and they even get shorter. It's deflationary. So inflation, deflation, growth and spending and not. And of course, business and government spending follows consumers. Consumers lead the boat. Businesses don't invest if consumers aren't spending more, and government tax revenues and their investments don't go up if consumers aren't spending more. Consumers drive the train, and they're typically 65 to 70% of GDP on top of that. Okay. So that's why my indicators work. Governments didn't understand this. So they thought, keep thinking, this is a short-term crisis. Oh, then they'll do all this. Oh, then we slump again. Well, then they kept upping the ante. They've been tricked into doubling down. They've been doing this. Now, look, you got to ask yourself a question, Michael. Any comments and further. If an economy takes constant escalating stimulus just to grow at 1.5 to 2%, then it's dead. Okay?
An interesting way of looking at it.
Pronounce that it's dead.
Well, some people would say the Reserve Bank here, the Fed in the United States, they're supporting the markets because they've learned. They've learned from the past. This is the new way of doing things. They're protecting us. Would that be fair?
Every time in history, as soon as things get good long enough, roaring 20s, people think, oh, we're in a new endless, we found the secret formula to endless prosperity. And it's always some sort of pushing interest rates down, government stimulus, government overbill. You know, there's always some artificial component to it. But part of it is the better things get, the more optimistic people feel. And then they do invest more and they do spend more until they get and they borrow more and feel okay about it until something goes wrong. And then, oops, oh, that's right. Then people go, what were we thinking? Every time people have borrowed too much, spent too much, whether it's individuals in their own household or countries over time, if you overspend and overborrow, you get in trouble and you have to pull back and maybe even go bankrupt, you know, and restructure your debts and your spending and your expenses. This is just common sense. There is no formula for growing forever with no recessions. The fact that economists don't get that makes me think they are the stupidest people on earth. A six-year-old could understand this, Michael. And they really think they could, their goal, which their goal already shows they don't understand economics, is to grow at 3-4% a year with 1-2% inflation with no recessions. You know what that economy gets you? It's called Japan.
Well, I've heard you say an economic winter's coming. We're about to have a great fallout, a great recession, maybe even a depression. Now, I heard you interviewed earlier this year when you thought the crash was going to come in February and another one when you thought it was going to come in June. Well, some people say you're just changing your timeline.
There's no change in it. It is coming because you can't do this forever, but they are escalating and they have continued to escalate. And so they will do that until something goes wrong. Although COVID hit, well, they escalated 10 times on that. I mean, they went, nobody, no liberal economist would have predicted what they did in advance in that crisis. Even I didn't think they'd go that far, knowing that they're desperate.
The recession you predicted last year was just a blip in Australia. We had one quarter of negative growth, and other economies picked up faster around the world than most predicted. So how bad will this crisis be, Harry?
Well, okay. My thing is the line in the sand for me is 2022. That's next year. The reason for that is I have said from the beginning, back in the early to mid 80s, when I started doing demographic forecasting, started projecting the baby boom's impact on countries and economies around the world, and which all came, people thought I was a bit more of a nut back then. People thought the U.S. economy would never be the same again after the long 70s recession and massive inflation. And then the rise of Japan made us all look like we didn't know how to walk, talk, or work anymore. They were so much more efficient than us. They were kicking our butts. So, no, I was predicting, no, greatest boom in history. And you got to remember this, Michael. This means there's no way I did this by accident, okay? At the time I was predicting, the U.S. and Europe and countries like Australia would see the greatest boom in history in the 80s, 90s, and early to mid-2000s. I predicted Japan would crash. I predicted that. All the way to 1989, Japan is going to crash. Biggest bubble in the world, most over real estate value in the world, just like in the developed countries now, just like now. And people thought I was crazy because they thought Japan could do no wrong. They were doing all the right things. And why am I so bullish on the U.S. and Europe when they're basically limping around like old people? Okay. So, but I was looking under the hood at the real things you can project in the future. And it said, no, Japan's had its baby boom, boom. They came earlier. And the U.S. is and Europe are just getting going. And the U.S. is going to be the strongest of the three. And Australia, of all those countries, would be the strongest, which all has happened.
So what's going to cause it to burst, Harry?
Okay. You hit limits. What I'm seeing in the U.S., I don't know that this is happening in Australia yet. I think it has to some degree. Like I said, and this has only been the last several months, real estate sales, home sales are down 23%, even though the economy is doing better with all the stimulus after COVID and income drop, everything else is up. Real estate home sales are down. Why? Because now we're almost 400,000 U.S. Think that's like, you know, 600,000 Australian or something. We're at levels where more and more people just can't afford a house or say, okay, this has gone too far. You guys are really second as a country only to China. And China is so off the charts that they're going to blow the biggest when this blows. China has tried to do capitalism with top-down government control. You know what that is, Michael? That's called the worst of all models. I'd rather just have pure government control or pure out cowboy capitalism. But for governments try to channel capitalism, governments always overstimulate to get reelected and please people. China has the greatest relative stimulus, the greatest debt ratios for an emerging country, 2 to 3 times India and their other Southeast Asian competitors. They are the biggest bubble in the world, and they are Australia's best export, not our best export customer, your best export customer. And you guys export 20 to 22% of your GDP. We export 11 to 12. So China is going to be what may kick you guys the hardest.
I'd like to talk about China in a moment, but you're an economist. And you know, for house prices to really collapse, you need very high unemployment. You need to have people have to sell their homes and no one to buy them. But at the moment, our unemployment levels are lower than they've been at the beginning of the pandemic. Job vacancies are at historic highs. So what's going to be the economic trigger for Australia's unemployment that would cause all this to happen?
Well, think of it this way. What's the largest area of spending for consumers? Do you happen to know that? Just take a wild guess. The largest single sector of spending for consumers in the developed world. Oh, it's housing. And real estate. And it gets overvalued to the point that people can't buy that anymore, or it's too big a drain on their thing, and they have to cut back. They can't eat out as much. They can't send their kids to private school. And things start crumbling. And the more things crumble, the more things other crumble. It's just like an avalanche. Ask yourself, what causes an avalanche of snow on the mountains? Of course, there's many other examples. What causes an avalanche? One snowflake.
Really?
The one thing that just starts a catalyst and makes a top and things start going the other way. And then just like things build on each other, the more the economy grows and the more lower interest, they push interest rates down, and the more stimulus, the more people feel good, the more they spend. And then businesses invest more. Everything goes the other way. Now you get the avalanche, just one snowflake too much, a little too much weight, and it starts to collapse. And then it just keeps collapsing on itself. Because every collapse causes somebody else to take a loss or debts to fail. And then it just, you know.
So, Harry, some people say you just don't understand Australia. You don't understand our fundamentals. You can't translate what's happening overseas to here. You're an outsider. How would you answer that?
Well, let me tell you what I'd answer that. Michael, you people in Australia are 25 million people in the middle of nowhere. You guys don't understand the world.
If you believe this is going to happen, what should a homeowner do? What should a property investor do? If people are listening to us, some of them are business owners. What's your advice?
Well, let me tell you what I did. I'm in Puerto Rico. I just bought a big house for the first time. Didn't intend to, but Puerto Rico's getting all this immigration because of tax advantage from the U.S., only affluent people, and they're bidding up certain areas. And I found a house through a friend. Somebody died. It was just sell, and it was like half of what it should have been. And I just bought it. I'm telling people, don't buy a house right now. We're in bubble number two in Australia, Europe, U.S., all the developed countries. Okay. I just bought a house because it was such a great deal and I can do so much improvement. But most people are sitting in real estate's overvalued. I tell you, look, you look at your whole picture. A lot of people, especially affluent people that we deal with, I know certainly I deal with, okay. I don't deal with Homer and Marge Simpson that make $50,000 a year to barely get by and eat lunch. They don't have the money to read my books or invest money, okay? So these people, they have a nice house, and then they bought a vacation house somewhere. And then sometimes they bought two or timeshares and stuff. Look at your overall real estate, especially most baby boomers are aging. Your kids are left nest a long time ago or recently. Okay, reassess it. What do you really need? What do you value the most? Sell off everything else. I just bought my first primary home in years, but I also just sold my vacation home in the island off of Puerto Rico.
Harry, you say gold's no longer a safe haven. I think you agree that silver isn't anymore. What about Bitcoin? That seems to be the flavor of the month.
I got a lot of crypto friends down here because they're moving to Puerto Rico for the tax advantages. They already made zillions, and they're going to make zillions more. People I know are richer than I'll ever be in a long time if they can keep it. What I do, and I've done this in the last couple of years, I compare this directly to the first tech bubble, 95 to early 2000. And the biggest part of that bubble came after the 98 crash, when the dot-com suddenly merged. You know, AOL was 402 times
earnings. Yeah, I remember.
Oh, that's not a bubble. That's what people were saying then. Oh, yeah, but it's the future company. Yeah, it is, but nobody. They were a sizable company. Nobody could fulfill that. So there was a bubble, early stage bubble, not just in the computer industry. No, it was the dot-com retailers. That was the new thing. Well, that's Bitcoin and crypto today. Block, and it's not crypto and a big, they're just banners for the blockchain revolution, okay? Which is, let me give you a one sentence definition. It's oversimplification, but it's true. The digitization of all financial assets and money. If you don't think that's a big thing in the future, that's as Internet 1.0 was about the digitization and networking of information and learning and communication. This is about finance and financial assets. So this is Internet 2.0. We're in the baby stage, just like those dot-coms. They were way overvalued, AOL at 402 times earnings. Come on. What did it do? Guess how much they crashed. Just take a wild guess between 0 and 100, how much the dot-com stocks crashed between 2000 and 2002.
Look, I remember those times well, and only a couple of the companies survived. They did really well if you bought Apple, if you bought Google, but boy, most of them didn't, did they? They all crashed.
The number is 94% for the leader, Amazon, and 95% for the total internet index, the dot-com index. They crashed big time, not in a big recession, not a Great Depression, just a minor recession, because they bubbled up in the early stages. Yes, they were the future, but they got overvalued. I call it the baby bubble. It crashed. What happened after 2002? The daddy internet bubble, which is only peaking now and would have peaked years ago if it hadn't been for all this stimulus. So that's where this blockchain and Bitcoin and crypto are this early stage stuff. Of course, it's overvalued. An invisible coin for $65,000, you know, it really isn't spendable. Try to buy something with Bitcoin, okay? Be my guest, okay? Go down the street and try to buy, go to the grocery store and say, okay, I got a Bitcoin here. I'm going to buy like this whole aisle three and see how far you get, okay? So it is. The digitization of all financial assets and money and currency, everything. It is the next big thing. I'm projecting by the late 2030s that the whole crypto blockchain industry will be like the internet is today when it was in its infancy in the late 90s. I am holding to, you're going to see an 85 to 95% crash in crypto and Bitcoin in the next few years, and then the greatest boom since the internet boom.
Well, for once, I agree with you. I agree with that. Now, Harry, in an economic downturn, as you say, it's a time for resetting of our economy. We know that. We know it's necessary. It's also a great time for transfer of wealth. So what upside do you see once we're through this downturn that you're saying is going to happen in a year or two's time? What's the upside?
Well I'll tell you, here's the biggest thing. You have to clean the decks, okay? There's 20% and growing, and this has all been in the last 10 years, zombie companies, companies that are still alive, public companies, not little small business, public large companies that cannot meet their debt service, but they're still alive because all this low interest rate and liberal banking and Fed lets them stumble along. They're going to get flushed out. A lot of bad companies going to get flushed out. And so that's going to re-divert a lot of resources, money, and labor ultimately to the new companies that are coming out of this. And where are they coming? They're coming in new industries appealing to the millennial generation, no longer the aging baby boomers. And they're coming to the whole blockchain technology industries that have, again, going to just revamp everything about money and financial assets. And that's huge. I mean, and you got to remember, what's the history of the world? But most people, I mean, back just a couple hundred years ago, 1% of people were not just the top, you know, 50% of income and 80% of financial wealth. They owned everything. Everybody else were peasants. Well, now everybody has some financial assets, and they're going to keep having more and more. So this financial revolution is a big thing about everyday people becoming more and more wealthy over time from innovations.
So you've been really, really generous with your time. I'd like to finish off on one other question, though. As you said, you've been to Australia often, 2011-12. I bought your books. I've actually still got them on the bookshelf behind me. I remember buying your first book at the airport where you talked about the boom. And since then, though, you've talked about the crashes. You're on this podcast in 2018 and 2020. If people listened to you 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, went to your seminars and they sold up their home or did what you recommended, what would you say to them if they followed you then and it didn't work out like you had hoped?
Well, first of all, this is why I have a newsletter. And you said earlier, harrydent.com, you get a free newsletter to get to know us, but you get on a paid newsletter. I am not, you know, I'll say, oh, gosh, it looks like things could be peaking, but then this happens and they step up more stimulus. I'll say, well, no, stocks are going to go higher. So, you know, I haven't had people constantly selling real estate for years. I have at times. And stocks are much easier because you can get out of them and get back in. So we have not been bearish the whole time. I've been bearish at times. I've been more bullish in recent years. And now I'm saying now we're getting to a closer point here. That every day we get closer to that late 2022, which is the real natural low in the economy for stocks and things like that. And as we start to see things like, oh, home sales are going down, even though prices are going up and the economy is okay. Okay, there's those signs, okay? There's leading indicators and things. So we're starting to see signs. And the best thing is, I just tell people right now, I'm always putting the stock market in my newsletter in a channel or a triangle or some pattern to say, okay, you can stay with this trend, but if it breaks this bottom trend line, that's when you need to start selling or getting concerned. I'm just not saying, oh, just sell. I'm saying here's when you need to be looking for a turning point sooner than later. And here's when you get worried. You don't get worried if we don't break this line. And, you know, we haven't broken the line in sand that I set a couple months ago. So I'm not bearish right now, but it wouldn't take much of a correction here to start violating some important levels.
Well, Harry, again, I really, really appreciate your time and your insights. And as I said at the beginning, I believe it's important to look at all views, and especially somebody like you who's got a really good track record. And while we don't fully agree, I do appreciate your time. So if people want to find out more, they can get your newsletter for free, as you say, at harrydent.com, and I'll leave a link in the show notes. And I look forward to catching up with you next year when we'll have a talk again and see how all this eventuates.
Yeah, next year is the make or break year for me. I mean, I'm going to have to revise a lot of things if we don't see some sort of crisis set in by then. Because really, I mean, I just say it, Michael, my fear is, and it's what's already happened with Japan. Japan stimulated first and got to do it more. And, you know, when everybody's doing it, it's harder. When you're the only one doing the party, it's easier to party. Okay. But they have been in this zombie economy forever now, 30 some years now, since 1989. And I was the only guy, literally. Wouldn't you want to listen to the guy that said Japan was going to collapse in 1989 when everybody thought they could do no wrong? Wouldn't you want to listen to the guy that was the most bullish in history when he finally turns bearish? That's all I'm saying. I am not bearish by nature. I've been bullish most of my career, but you can't look something like this, this much bubble with this much artificial stimulus and not be suspicious. If you are, you got some really bad, hard, painful lessons to learn is all I can tell you. And I feel sorry for you if you're not at least suspicious of all. If you're not suspicious of this economy, then you don't have your brain working. I'm sorry. That's all I can say.
So you're making us think differently, and that's really good, and I appreciate it. Thank you for your time, Harry.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
If you're a regular listener to my podcast, you know, most shows only go for about 30 minutes. And my chat with Harry Dent, as just part of this podcast, went a lot longer than that. Firstly, I couldn't get a word in edgeways. And secondly, I thought it was interesting to hear his views. Firstly, to hear an alternative point of view. Secondly, for a little bit of entertainment. Boy, was he passionate. But as I said at the beginning, don't sell up all your assets. Don't go hide in a cave. I think there are some really good times ahead for the Australian property markets in our economy, and we're going to talk about that in a moment
with Pete Wargent. Before I do, if you actually want to get a sound view of what's happening in our property markets, if you're looking for direction, certainty, results in your wealth creation, why not have a chat with my team at Metropole? Just go to metropole.com.au and find out a bit about what we do, because we can help you with sound advice. We're not as outspoken and outrageous as Harry is, but we've got a track record of having bought over $4 billion worth of properties for clients over the years, currently managing over $2 billion worth of assets for clients, and won multiple awards. It all starts with putting a strategic plan together, and then you can use our buyer's agency services, property management, renovations, development, wealth advisory, financial planning. We've got a range of services to give you holistic wealth advice, sound advice, evidence-based advice. Having said that, it's always still worth hearing the other point of view just to see what else is out there in the world, and that's why I had a chat with Harry, but I'd rather you have a chat with my team at Metropole. Go to metropole.com.au, find out how we can be part of your wealth creation journey. And now, let's hear what Pete Wargent has to say about Harry's outrageous claims. Well, now that we've heard Harry Dent's view, let's unpack what he has to say and let's burst his bubble. And I'm going to do that today with Pete Wargent, who is a chartered accountant, a chartered secretary. He's got a financial planning diploma, and he's taken a different approach to Harry Dent. He's had a long-term approach to building businesses, investing in equities, owning a property portfolio. He's achieved financial independence. So he's not just a theorist. And a lot of people would call him one of Australia's leading financial commentators. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Michael. Good to be back on.
Now, Pete, some people would have suggested we shouldn't even be responding to these outrageous predictions, but I feel it's always worth at least examining the other side of view. Pete, Harry Dent's basic premise is that we're in a bubble and it must burst. So I'd like to take your view on bubbles. Are we in a bubble? Does it have to burst?
Well, no and no. I mean, this is obviously not the first time we've had a discussion about some of Harry Dent's predictions. He made a similar prediction from memory 3 or 4 years ago. And then, in fact, about 9 years ago, he made very similar predictions for Australia. So let's be honest, a lot of Harry Dent's profile is raised by making outlier forecasts, the extreme forecasts, rather than the plausible scenarios. And I think what we're seeing, and this isn't just my view, this is the view of, for example, you know, NAB and AMP and the Centre for Independent Studies, we're basically seeing record low mortgage rates, and a fairly rational response to that is likely to be more people getting into the housing market. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And this is not just my prediction. There's a lot of people run the numbers, and they probably expect, roughly speaking, about 30% growth this cycle, simply because we've got the lowest mortgage rates we've seen. So yes, there are always risks, but yeah, some of these sort of bubble scenarios, I think they're probably on the wrong side of the trade, to be honest.
Well, Harry believes that our property markets, other than China, are the most overvalued in the world. But in my mind, a bubble is an economic cycle characterized by a rapid escalation in asset values that are then followed by contraction. But it's created by a huge surge in asset prices that are unwarranted by the fundamentals. That's different to a rise in price. The bubble's because of exuberant market behavior. And then at the end, when there's no more investors willing to buy at the elevated prices, a massive sell-off's got to occur. And yes, they have occurred in economies. They have occurred in the tech stocks and probably in Bitcoin as well and in business sectors. But if we talk about the Australian housing market, currently it's underpinned more by owner-occupiers. Sure, investors are coming in a bit, but it seems to be underpinned by fundamental values, by the supply and demand, by a shortage of new stock coming on, and despite closed borders, still strong demand.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, the characteristics of a bubble, you would normally be talking about a huge run-up in values. And I mean, it's true that Australian property was coming from a high base, but actually, as you said, we actually had a downturn 2017 when the credit restrictions happened. We rolled into a banking royal commission all the way through to the May 2019 election. So prices had actually come off quite a bit, particularly in Sydney and in inner city Melbourne. Some of the unit prices were down. And then it was only really from mid-2019 that the cycle began. And as you said, it's not really been driven by investors, barely at all. It's been home buyers coming into the market. Only just in the last couple of months have investors started to join the cycle. So it doesn't feel to me like it's anything like close to the end of a cycle, let alone a bubble. Much more likely we'll see investor activity increasing over the next 6 to 12 months. It's probably something that the regulator will watch. They won't want investors to get too active, but I mean, we're coming off record low credit growth for investors, so it's hardly like we're at that point just yet. It's just probably something to watch over the next 12 months if it starts to get overheated in terms of investors. Yeah, as you said, I mean, stock levels are down over 20% from a year ago. So if you're finding it hard to buy, that's why there's just a real stock shortage. And even the older stock is getting cleared now. So the fundamentals are basically pointing towards rising housing prices much more so than they are a bubble.
Well, the other argument Harry's got is that our governments are spending too much. In fact, it's not just Harry. Other bubblers are saying to us that the government's taking on too much debt. The economy is going to collapse under this significant amount of debt. All they've done is kick the can down the road, which is what I think Harry's done because he keeps pushing his predictions further and further along. And others are suggesting the Australian households, not just the government, are taking on too much debt. What would your take be on that?
Yeah, I mean, the global debt issue is a significant one. In terms of government debt, Australia was coming from a low base. We've had, relatively speaking, quite a prudent budget management in Australia. In fact, the budget was actually back into balance or near enough back in balance before the COVID crisis came along. And of course, you know, now the deficit's been blown out of the water. But we're not talking about high levels of government debt in Australia. And of course, the rates... interest rates at which the bonds are being issued, and we've never seen such low rates, so the interest burden is very low. So it's not such a big issue for Australia. Household debt it certainly is high, relatively high in Australia, partly because the government doesn't own very much housing stock at all, unlike other countries. So private debt tends to be a bit higher in Australia anyway. So rental properties tend to be owned by landlords rather than the government. But actually, household debt-to-income ratios have come down quite a bit, partly because incomes are up and all of that stimulus has made a difference. And the Bank for International Settlements showed of all the countries across the developed world, the excess household savings through the pandemic, Australia's right at the top of the tree, over 6% boost to excess household savings. So that alone can continue to fuel a consumption boom and most likely a continuation of the housing boom as well.
Well, recently, the Reserve Bank, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, Credit Suisse overseas have all shown us that Australians in general have become wealthier during the pandemic. We're the wealthiest nation in the world.
Yeah, there's obviously different ways to measure that. In terms of median household wealth, then Australia is actually top of the tree. If you're looking at average household wealth, it can be skewed by some of those countries with a lot of super rich. So Switzerland tends to fare well on these sort of average measures. But if you're looking at median figures, Australia is right at the top, you know, the highest in the world. You know, there are some sort of nuances in terms of how that's measured. For example, in Australia, all of the superannuation balances get captured, whereas in some European countries, pension balances are much harder to measure with defined benefit and so on. But, you know, that's a technical point. Basically, Australia's on average, you know, probably the wealthiest place on the planet. So we can't go too far wrong. And with those kind of numbers and the number of US dollar millionaires has really increased significantly again over the past year, partly because of exchange rate, but largely because housing and stocks are doing very well.
Sure. So I would think that Harry doesn't understand Australian real estate or the Australian economy like he says he does. In the past, we've said population growth's underpinned our property markets, but clearly there hasn't been any in the last year. Yet it's the supply and demand ratio, as we were saying, that's held property values high. But we actually have a very sound banking system, well-regulated and reasonably risk-averse. So from what I can see, the debt that's out there is in the hands of people who can manage it, Pete.
Yes, and that's we've seen that even over the past 15 years. You can see the increase in household debt has been almost exclusively in the top two quintiles by household income, so i.e. the people who can afford it, and obviously interest rates are low. I think that's an interesting point on the on sort of Harry Dent's understanding of Australia. So I suppose there's, and I've got no bone to pick with Harry Dent at all, but I think by his own admission, he would be very much looking at the macro. And in fact, I did actually bump into Harry Dent. I may have told this anecdote before. I bumped into him 4 or 5 years ago on George Street, and he was looking for Town Hall Station with a map. So clearly at the micro level, you know, somebody who can get lost on George Street is obviously not a local expert, but you know, Harry would say he's looking at the macro figures. I think at the micro level, there may be some instances of markets overheating. And I know your colleague, Brett Warren, has talked about this. In every cycle, there'll be some parts of Australia. We saw it in the mining boom where mining towns just got massively overbid. I think this time around, maybe some of those regional markets which have seen a temporary spike in demand because people look to hide away from their city bolt holes. I mean, maybe there are some regional markets where things could go into reverse as the CBD comes back to life. But I think overall, and you know, the macro level, it's very hard to say there's a bubble. And as I said, that's not just me saying that. Look at all the forecasters out there looking at 30% growth through the cycle. It's you know, it's a rational response to where mortgage rates have gone.
Just continuing on the debt argument, Harry uses the argument, as do others, about the house prices compared to income levels. And there are different ways of working out proportions of that. His suggestion is, other than China, Australia's house prices are at record highs as opposed to our income level. But he doesn't seem to take into account what the cost of money is today.
No, and actually, it's not strictly speaking true anyway. And don't take my word for it. Go to a website called Numbeo, N-U-M-B-E-O, and look at the way in which countries are measured as quality of life indexes and so on. If you look at the property price to income ratios, Australia might be around about 7, possibly 8 at the top end. Obviously, China's very high. Hong Kong would be about 45, but there's probably about 70 countries that are ahead of Australia, partly because incomes are across much of the world are far lower, of course, than in Australia. So it depends really who you're comparing with, but certainly there's a whole range of countries where property price to income ratios are higher than Australia. And as you said, well, if you're borrowing at 2% or even lower in some cases, affordability has actually improved a heck of a lot, particularly for established property owners.
Well, Harry's worried about the Chinese housing market. In fact, the Chinese economy, he believes it's a bubble waiting to burst there because the government has built too many houses. He says 25% of the properties are vacant there, and it's going to cause the biggest housing crash in history in China, and that's going to cause China's demand for commodities to collapse, which is then going to have the domino effect and cause Australia's exports to collapse, which is then going to have the domino effect of causing Australia's house prices to collapse. That's drawing a pretty long bow.
Well, yes, and it's not a new story. So, I mean, if you rewound the clock by a decade, there would have been people saying the same thing. And, you know, back then it was the ghost cities like Ordos, Kangbashi, and all these places where the cities were built first and then they filled up later. So, yeah, I mean, no question, vacant properties across China, but that's been an issue for over a decade. And the market just seems to work in a different way over there. And, of course, the economy in general works in a very different way. So, clearly, Chinese debt has been an issue on the radar for over a decade, but to date, nothing really has transpired from that. But I think the vacant properties issue in China, you know, there was stories a decade ago of 60 million empty flats or apartments, and nothing really ever transpired from that. It just seems to work somewhat differently. But obviously, you know, it's been a different economic history for China.
And it's also who owns those properties, because those properties aren't necessarily in private hands like they are in Australia. Now, I like Harry's thoughts that demographics do drive our markets. And when I first read his books way back, I think it was in the 80s, and he saw what was ahead depending upon aging baby boomers. It all started to make sense. So he's suggesting that there aren't enough people coming behind them, the millennials and young taxpaying people, to support the aging economy. But I think the government, once the borders are open, are going to address that. I mean, that was one of the thoughts of the intergenerational report recently released also, but it wasn't as dire a prediction as that.
No, and in fact, as Harry himself has said on numerous occasions, of all the places in the world where demographics are not such a big issue, Australia's top of the pile, because since really the mining boom years, we've been focusing on those under 30s migrants. So not just international students, but also skilled migrant visas, including myself. I came along to Australia in my 20s. So that tends to help because you've got people who are paying tax for decades on end. It increases the participation rate. So Australia will have an aging population too. And the intergenerational report did reflect that. But as you said, I mean, you know, this is a temporary blip. The borders won't stay closed forever. And when they do reopen, I suspect Australia will be, alongside New Zealand, probably the most attractive of places, you know, not just because of the wealth in Australia, but it's also been safe and clean and good education. So a temporary blip, I think, in terms of immigration, but we don't have the rapidly aging population issues that, say, China or Japan do. So Australia, relatively speaking, is pretty well set there.
I think another way Australia is different to other overseas countries is we've got a culture of home ownership. In many countries overseas, people expect to be tenants for life. But it's not just the Australians, it's our government. They want us to own properties. And because of the culture of home ownership, it's encouraged first home buyers, it's given all sorts of incentives, it's encouraging property investors with tax breaks, it recognises it needs property investors to supply housing to a large percentage of our population. And that's unlikely to change. The government's not going to suddenly get into the public housing sector in a big way moving forward.
No, and in fact, if you look at public housing and public sector dwelling approvals, they've basically never been lower. It's been abandoned as a strategy. The figures on home ownership always lag a great deal, but I suspect we've actually seen an increase in home ownership rates recently, and we haven't seen that for many years. A lot of investors were in the market from 2012, but it's all been about home buyers and particularly first home buyers recently. So that home ownership dream, you know, people talk a lot about it having faded, but it hasn't really. The desire is still there. And the first home loan deposit scheme has seen thousands of first home buyers getting into the market over the past year. And that will continue, actually, over the next 6-12 months. So, yeah, I think home ownership rates are high, relatively high in Australia. That will probably continue. And often people choose to rent and invest, get a foothold on the ladder elsewhere. So it's not always perfectly captured by the headline home ownership rates anyway.
So in summary, Harry suggested this was going to happen 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago. I heard him earlier this year say if the bubble doesn't burst by June this year, which is already gone, he's going to hang up his shingle. And now he's suggesting this is going to happen in 2022, late 2022 or 2023. I couldn't pin him down to exactly what's going to cause the bubble to burst. He just said it must because of the huge debt. Now, he is right that economies work in cycles. We will have a recession again one day. It will clean out some zombie companies, as he calls them. But I can't see one happening in the short-term future, Pete.
No, I mean, if you'd have asked me, I don't know, March or April 2020, there was a huge amount of uncertainty at that point about what might happen in terms of the spread of the virus, what might happen in terms of, you know, we hadn't really seen lockdowns before. So it was very hard to, a lot of different scenarios that could have happened, but the stimulus has been absolutely unprecedented, not just interest rates, but also fiscal stimulus from the government. And as it's transpired, Australia's probably, if anything, gone possibly a little bit too hard, maybe some might say, on the stimulus. So I think, you know, as you said, these things go in cycles. The peak of the housing market cycle might come in 2023. I suspect it might be 2024 even before we see interest rates rising meaningfully. In theory, anything could happen, but I'm not seeing prices falling anytime soon. Probably the one thing to watch is just whether the regulator gets involved in terms of cooling investor activity if it starts to overheat.
So I think you agree with me. Don't be scared. Don't sell up your houses. What are you going to do? Suddenly become a tenant, wait for properties to drop and buy back again? That's not the strategy at all. But I guess it's always sensible to be at least prudent and manage your debt smartly and your money smartly, Pete.
That's one of the things. We've got excess household savings in Australia through the past year. So always makes sense to shore up the household balance sheet, keep a good buffer. A lot of people use mortgage offset facilities these days. You can make excess repayments if you want to. But yeah, I mean, it always makes sense to manage risk first and foremost. But in terms of the house price outlook, I suspect probably more to the upside at the moment.
I'd agree with you. Thanks a lot. It's fun busting Harry's bubble once a year. Look forward to catching up with you for our regular big picture podcasts that we do once a month again real soon. Thanks, Pete.
Sounds great. Thanks, Michael.
Now, of course, before we go, I really should say that if people like to hear what you have to say, where can they find out about you? And maybe you tell us a bit about your podcast as well, Pete.
Pete Wargent Blogspot is my daily blog, or PeteWargent.com, plenty of places to track me down. Our podcast is called the Low Rates, High Returns podcast, and that's very much more of a stock market podcast. So if you're interested in investing in stocks and creating income from the stock market, well, that's another place that you might check out. But easiest place to find me, just hop onto Google or Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find.
And I'll leave some links in the show notes as well. And obviously, we run your blogs, some of them on Property Update as well. Thanks for your time, Pete.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Well, that was a longer show than normal, wasn't it? But I hope you got some benefit from it. You learned some things, you got a different perspective, and now, after hearing Pete and me, you're feeling a bit more secure about your future. And if you got some benefit from today's show, and you know somebody else who'd benefit, why not tell them about that? Tell them about the Michael Yadney podcast, or you can tell the world by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Now, you can catch me in between these twice weekly shows. Just look for me on social media, look for Michael Yardney, or why not join my private Facebook group, where every day I leave a snippet, I leave a chart, I leave some commentary, just something a bit different which you won't get elsewhere to get my views on what's ahead. Just go to Facebook and look for the Property Update private Facebook group. I look forward to being part of your wealth creation journey. I'll be back again real soon with a normal show, a shorter show. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropol, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropol to help you?